I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Is the Trump administration protecting America's secrets? More than a year after the president took office, why do so many of his closest aides still lack permanent authorization to see classified material? Many of them, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, may lose their interim security clearances in a couple of days. How will that affect their ability to do the work of the U.S. government? An indictment by special counsel Robert Mueller details pervasive Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Are we prepared to counter efforts to influence this year's elections? And are Russians the only ones who seek to tip the scales when other countries go to the polls? Keeping secrets secure. Deb Reekman of the Associated Press and Scott Shane of the New York Times join me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. When President Donald Trump's staff secretary, Rob Porter, was let go earlier this month after allegations became public that he had physically abused two of his former wives, his departure cast a spotlight on security clearances. Porter, it became clear, had been working at the White House and presumably handling classified material with only an interim security clearance. And he's not the only one. The Congressional Research Service estimates that about 1.4 million people hold top secret clearances. But as many as 100 Trump political appointees do not. Their ranks include presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner. Last week, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats said the system of approving security clearances for top officials is, quote, broken and must be overhauled. A couple of days after Coats' Senate testimony, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly wrote a memo outlining an overhaul of how the White House manages security clearance investigations. In that memo, obtained by the Washington Post, some White House staffers with top secret interim clearances, a group that may include Jared Kushner, will lose their clearance on Friday. My guests today, two reporters who have been covering national security matters for years. Deb Reekman has written about national security for the Associated Press for the past 6 years. Before that, she was an AP reporter in Afghanistan. She also covered the Clinton and George W. Bush White Houses for the AP. She joins us on the line from the studios at the AP in Washington. Hi, Deb. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Scott Shane is with me here in Studio A. He's with the investigative unit of the New York Times. He's written about national security as a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Times since 2004. He's also the author of the books Dismantling Utopia on the Soviet Collapse and Objective Troy about the American terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki. Scott, it's good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
So, Deb, as I mentioned, you know, so many people have top secret clearance here in the United States. The estimate is, you know, almost 1.5 million people. And there are some 4.3 million people that have some kind of security clearance. Walk us through, what is the process that the FBI goes through to determine whether or not a person is worthy of security clearance?
Well, there's different kinds of background investigations for different kinds of clearances. There's a very minimal suitability background investigation for just someone who's not going to be even dealing with classified material. And then there's anything from there all the way up to top secret and secret. And plus, there's a couple other categories on the very top of that, that people who have top secret or secret clearances need to get clearance to handle certain kinds of information. The background investigation typically involves, you know, history of employment, history in the courts, any kind of charges. It just runs the gamut. Neighbors, financial, past employment, bankruptcies. There's a host of things that that are looked into, people's contacts with foreign governments, their nationalities, their travel. It's mm-hmm. a very long list.
Yeah, and I understand there's, you know, a dozen or so, 13, 14 different areas of concerns that people try to scope out. They do this in person. They travel to different places talking to people who may have had interactions with the person under consideration. Is it abnormal at this point in an administration, more than a year in, that as many as 100 people still lack security clearances.
I think people would be surprised at how many people in the government still have interims. I don't think anybody really knows for sure. We've been trying to get that number. It's somewhere between 0 and 330,000 because there's smarter people than I would know a little bit clearer how many there are. But there's a backlog out there of investigations. I think it's like 690,000 people. But that number includes not only the ones who are being reinvestigated because they have periodic reviews of people who hold clearances. That number also includes the people who are just now getting them, so they would be new clearances. So of the backlog of about 690,000, there's about 330,000 that are in the non-review category, the newer category.
Mm-hmm. And Scott Chain, 690,000 is a whole lot of people. There is a contingent of observers of this kind of thing in and out of the government who think that perhaps for a long time now we are overclassifying things and we are making too much of this, that we're granting clearances that really aren't even necessary to grant. What do you think about the fact that, gosh, it's nearly 700,000 people are still in line to get cleared?
Yeah, that's a long line. I mean, this was a much-discussed problem before 9/11. If you asked basically almost any government official who, in sort of the security agencies, is there too much classified information? Are too many things classified unnecessarily? And do too many people have clearances? They would say yes. But, like so many things, it just kept growing. And after 9/11, it was on steroids. I mean, the CIA, NSA, FBI, all bulked up by thousands and thousands of employees, huge numbers of contractors. And so the number of clearances, people with clearances, took off again. And it actually just in the last years of Obama, they began to trim back a little bit and the number of clearances began to fall a little bit. But it's still this huge number of people. And of course, that, in a way is self-defeating, because if you give 4 million people security clearances and tell them secrets, assuming that, one in a million has contact with a foreign intelligence service or is crazy, you're just increasing the odds that some of these secrets are going to get out.
Yeah, and Deb Riekman, you wrote about the White House explanation for the fact that Rob Porter, for example, clearly had a glitch in his security clearance process. The FBI was not willing to recommend him for authorization. But here he is, the staff secretary to the president, putatively handling classified, highly classified documents. What is the White House current position on how that all came down? This is the thing that evidently animated the memo by Chief of Staff John Kelly. But the White House has been a little unclear as to who knew what when and who said stuff at different times.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to understand that the FBI does not make recommendations for who is supposed to get a security clearance, nor do they actually do the approval or disapproval of someone. That is up to the agency that has employed the person who they want to have a clearance. So the buck doesn't really stop at the FBI. It really stops at the White House. So there's no real recommendations. The background investigation is completed. The FBI shares the information. And that's pretty much it on the FBI side. Apparently, there was some request for an additional investigation, additional material they were looking for or needed to be done. And that supplemental information then again was just transferred back over to the White House. So I'm pretty sure that the buck is really stopping at the White House, not at the FBI.
And Christopher Wray testified to the Senate Intel Committee last week that on two occasions last year, they provided the Trump administration with information about Rob Porter. And as you say, they're not the ones that say you should do this or you shouldn't do this. They simply say, here's the information and it's your call. If somebody in the White House, General Kelly, for example, or anybody else, would make a decision that a particular person should not be granted security clearance. Am I correct in understanding, Deb, that the president has the authority to overrule that determination?
I believe he does.
So if, for example, Jared Kushner happens to be in this list of people who were not approved prior to June 1st, and he is denied his interim clearance as of Friday in a couple of days, the president could say, nope, I'm going to let him have clearance.
Scott, I'm not sure of the answer to that question. It might be a legal answer, but my understanding is the White House gets to decide.
Yeah,
but maybe there's some caveats here.
Neither Deb nor I is a lawyer, but I think the answer is yes. I mean, ultimately, the whole issuance of security clearances comes under the president's commander-in-chief powers. All classified information is ultimately derived from his power as commander-in-chief, and ditto security clearances. So just as if the president decides to utter something that's been classified, you know, on national TV, he has not only that legal power, but it, you know, essentially is sort of declassified as it comes out of his mouth, because it's his decision as to whether it's classified or not. Ultimately, his people can advise him to grant the clearance or not grant the clearance, but I think he would ultimately make the decision.
It's interesting to me, as I read the memo from General Kelly, Deb Riekman, the standards and the metrics that are employed to determine whether or not somebody should be qualified or disqualified from receiving top secret security clearance. And one of the things that Kelly writes in this memo, he says, in the past, credible and substantiated reports of past domestic abuse, even physical abuse, were not considered automatic disqualifiers for suitability for employment or a security clearance. That needs to be revisited. Generally, our treatment of behavior that traditionally may not have been disqualifying should be modernized. So it seems like Kelly is saying, you know, back in my day, if you were abusive to your wife, that wasn't enough to get you fired from the White House. So is this, are even the standards for qualification an evolving situation here?
Now we're going to get into a he said, she said kind of a thing. Allegations are one thing. Convictions are another. Arrests are another. So, you know, a person can have allegations that they've abused their wife, and perhaps the, you know, this is not really what happened. You know, it, you don't really know what took place here. And if they want to overlook allegations, then I think that they can do that.
Mm-hmm. One thing to keep in mind is that what the security, you know, officials are thinking about is often the possibility of blackmail.
Right.
So, for example, if somebody has a history of domestic abuse and a foreign intelligence agency gets a hold of this, they can go to that person and say, you know, we have pictures of your wife with her black eye. We have a lot of other evidence. Be a shame if that was made public. But if you cooperate with us and share some classified information with us, then maybe we can make it all go away. So it's the possibility of blackmail that's often under consideration in these clearance issues.
Yeah, and Deb, in this case, in Mr. Porter's case, maybe he's definitely unblackmailable now, because every indiscretion he ever had or violent act he had towards not one but two wives, and there is photographic evidence that he was abusive to at least one of the wives. It's all, the cat's out of the bag. I mean, so.
But then again, he's not passing the paperwork into the Oval Office anymore.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right, we got to take a break. We will come back and talk more about national security matters. Scott Shane is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's based in their Washington bureau. Deb Riekman covers national security for the Associated Press. When we come back from a break, we'll try to sneak in some of your comments and questions. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It is, in fact, midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, an update on recovery efforts in Puerto Rico with Noah Steinberg DiStefano. He's an emergency relief worker for Lutheran World Relief. He has just returned from Puerto Rico. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Skeleton Crew. That's the new play at Baltimore Center Stage. That's coming up tomorrow on midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about national security and the number of people in the Trump administration who lack full security clearance, which would likely affect their ability to do their jobs. Deb Reekman covers national security for the Associated Press. Scott Shane is the national security reporter for the New York Times. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. Our phone number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at wypr.org, and our Twitter handle at midday WYPR. So Scott, is there any notion that anybody in the government has expressed concern, for example, about the danger of a person like Jared Kushner having secure, or at least having access to things like the president's daily brief? We understand that reporting has said, you know, Kushner reads these things, even the president doesn't. I mean, he must get video chats about it or something, or PowerPoint presentations. But if it turns out that Kushner has been reading these highly sensitive documents like the daily brief from the CIA and the intelligence community, and he shouldn't have been reading it, is that breaking a law?
You know, I guess I'd have to turn to a legal authority for that. I don't really know the answer to that question, but I think the assumption is that Jared Kushner's clearance has not been delivered because perhaps he failed to report a whole series of meetings that he had with foreign officials. And some of that related to his work. He comes from a big real estate business. Of course, he's famously owns a bunch of apartment complexes around Baltimore. And he's had dealings with investors from multiple countries. So I think the concern is that, you know, and it's very theoretical, no one has proven anything like this. You know, the concern would be that if Jared Kushner came under, for example, financial pressure from somebody who had invested one of his businesses or loaned him money, that, you know, they might want to get a hold of some secrets concerning China, concerning Russia, concerning some other power, and that he might be compromised in that way. That's the whole reason, you know, I mean, that may be unfair to Mr. Kushner to even raise that, but of course, that's the whole reason we have this system of security clearances, is to prevent that from happening. So it is alarming, I think, to some people in the intelligence world to see how many people only have interim clearances and are not yet fully cleared to, you know, to be reading this top secret stuff.
And Deb Reekman, explain to us what an interim clearance means.
Well, especially in cases where there's a transition of, you know, Obama to Trump, for example, you've got a whole bunch of new officials that have to take their jobs, you know, right on Inauguration Day. So it's pretty impossible to have everyone cleared and have everyone issued a permanent security clearance in that time frame. Oftentimes, they don't even know who is going to be holding those jobs until after they took office. So it's not unusual at all to have a lot of people having interims at the very beginning of an administration. I think going into a year or 2 years, it gets a little bit more dicey.
Do they issue interim clearances at the various levels? I mean, are there some people who get interim, you know, top super duper
Correct.
Secret, and others get, you know, middle of the road clearance, and others
Correct.
Get low clearance? Yeah. So they have to sort of make gut decisions initially, and then they parse it out as time goes on?
Yes. I think this is a pretty subjective
Yeah.
process.
Yeah, sounds like it. And General Kelly and Dan Coats, the National Intelligence Director, have both called for sweeping reforms in the way that clearances are issued. You've written about that, Deb. What is General Kelly saying is going to happen moving forward at the White House?
Well, he's saying that anyone who has a background check that's been pending since June 1st, they're going to be losing their interim clearance. I think Kushner's gave additional information to the FBI after that period, so I think that doesn't really apply to him. We should probably mention, though, that, you know, Kelly and Coates are not the first intelligence or officials or law enforcement officials who've been calling for security clearance reform. This has really been a debate that's been going on for a long, long time, many, many years. And I think this particular news story is probably going to put some wind into the sails of those who have been seeking reform for many years. Yeah. There's a lot of different ideas out there on how that's done.
And Scott Chain, in his testimony to the Senate Intel Committee last week, Mr. Coates said we need to revolutionize the way we do this. I mean, he's calling for a very different approach to it. And one of the things he alluded to was taking advantage of new technologies and information, saying that some of this stuff doesn't have to be tracked down with individual visits, you know, sending FBI agents to faraway places to confirm things, that stuff can, you can use the internet for it. And of course, you have written a lot about how the Russians, for example, have used the internet to do all sorts of stuff concerning the elections that we just had a couple of years ago. You know, the Director Coates said an approach would be faster and more effective than, quote, having to go to 19 different places to talk to people and neighbors and school classmates and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, my impression, and, you know, I mean, living in Baltimore with all those NSA folks out there, and, you know, I suspect that many of the people who are listening to this either had a clearance in the past, and their friends and relatives have been approached by some person who knocked on the door and said, do you know this person? And can you confirm that they live across the street, and so on and so forth? And it is a very inefficient way to gather information. So they can certainly streamline it. The other aspect of this is that many, many of the people who hold clearances, I think close to a million these days, are contractors. They're not government employees. And when people leave these security agencies in particular, they often go to work for contractors. And, you know, there is real financial value to the individual in having a clearance. If you have a background with the FBI, the CIA, NSA, and you want to find employment, your best bet, your best paid work is going to be with a contractor that will require you to have a secret or top secret clearance. So if that process gets slowed down or screwed up in some way, you know, it can really derail people's jobs, people's careers. So, you know, in a very practical level, they really need to sort of streamline this process and improve it.
Yeah, and Deb, it's costly to businesses, because there are businesses who are contractors who require people to have clearance because they're working on classified projects, and they are losing money if some of the people they're trying to hire are part of this 690,000 group that hasn't been cleared. I mean, there is a financial implication to this on both the government side and the business side, isn't there?
Yes, that's one idea that they have on reform. It's called reciprocity, and that is, if you're working for the NSA and you're going to be moving to a contractor, you can take your security clearance with you, so to speak. It doesn't have to be completely overhauled, and they don't have to start from the beginning. Same if you go from an agency to an agency, CIA to NSA, or back, or contractor to contractor, or contractor back to the government. So it turns out that these things have to be owned by the agency that the person is working for, or the contractor that the person is working for. So they have to kind of start over all the time, and that just adds to the backlog. There's another idea that they're kicking around that is already being used over at the Pentagon, and it's a process called continuous vetting. And right now, if you have a security clearance, you have to be what they call re-upped. You have to be reinvestigated after a number of years to make sure you haven't gone, you know, bad. And so, like, every 5 or 7 years, they go and do this all again. Again, that's adding to the backlog. And it doesn't really make much sense in this high-paced information environment that we're living in to wait 7 years to find out if somebody has, you know, been talking to a foreign government or sharing secrets.
Yeah, you could do a lot of damage in 7 years, yeah.
Right, so it doesn't really make much sense, one, to wait that long. And there are ways that they can you know, continuously vet a person because of the technology that exists today. They can routinely check bankruptcies. They can routinely check, you know, law enforcement databases or whatever, what have you. And that's called continuous vetting. And so if you had a security clearance, you would then be kind of not in a grace period for 7 years. You would be constantly watched, and it would eliminate all these, you know, clearances from having to be re-upped.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that's already going on at in the defense industry, and I believe they've even got about 1 million people on that already.
Yeah. One thing that has another development that has focused attention on clearances, and maybe sort of from the other side of this question, is recent leaks from NSA. So in particular, there was a gentleman who lived in Glen Burnie by the name of Harold Martin, Hal Martin. And he was a longtime contract employee of NSA and other agencies. And, you know, it turned out they went to his house in August of 2016, and it turned out that he had been walking out with classified material for 20 years from multiple organizations. He had top secret material in his car, in a shed, in his garden, in his house. He had, I believe it was 50 terabytes of information that he'd taken home. And he'd never been detected, despite going through multiple, re-ups on his clearance, multiple background investigations. So that, of course, when something like that happens, everybody in Congress and in the public says, how did this guy have a clearance? You know, why didn't they catch this? And, of course, that leads the agencies to want to tighten up. But if you make the background investigations even more thorough, that means the backlog of cases gets even longer. So there is this kind of back and forth between how careful do you want to be versus how efficient do you want to be.
410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio by Scott Shane of the New York Times. On the line from the AP Bureau in Washington is Deb Reekman. And, Scott, the convergence of these security breaches and election meddling is quite clear. In June of 2017, a woman named Reality Lee Winner, who was a contractor, one of these many contractors who had top security clearance, was arrested for leaking information to the Russians, which they at least attempted to use to influence voting places, polling processes in the country. So, when we talk about meddling in the elections, there's a consequence to some of this stuff being leaked.
That's not quite what she's accused of doing. She leaked some top secret documents to the publication The Intercept, and the documents were about Russian efforts to break into voting systems and voting software vendors in the United States. So that's right. I mean, she had access, because she had a top secret clearance, she had access to information that had not been publicly disclosed about essentially what the U.S. had learned about Russian.
Yeah, so Russians were tipped off as to what was known.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Deb Reekman, you've written about the president's assertions about Russia. He tweeted the other day, I've been much tougher on Russia than Obama. Just look at the facts. Total fake news, which is a common trope of the president's. But when you do look at the facts, they don't quite line up the way the president is asserting.
I'm not sure either administration did all that much. I know the investigation was underway during Obama. I know that they were working behind the scenes to find out about this, but I'm not sure that there were any super big steps that were taken. I mean, the Obama administration did, kick out a bunch of diplomats. The sanctions were issued, but I don't know.
And of course, you know, Scott Shane, the Obama administration did seek to declassify. This was after the election, but did seek to declassify some of what it had learned about Russian involvement in the 2016 election. They've taken a lot of criticism for not doing enough before the election, but the president, I guess, President Obama at the time thought himself to be between a rock and a hard place when it came to pursuing this and making public how they were doing that and seeming to try to tip the scale on the election.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think part of the is a catch-22 in any case, because if the president of the United States says the Russians are hacking and it may affect the outcome of the election, he's calling into question in a very public way, the reliability of the voting, and ultimately affecting potentially Americans' trust that the right person won, that the election actually was a fair and free election. So I think any president would tread lightly. And in this particular case, everybody assumed that Hillary Clinton, whom, of course, Obama supported, was going to win. So, you know, why cast aspersions on the reliability of the election when it's all going to be over and Clinton will be president? And he certainly didn't want to play into what Donald Trump was saying at the time, which is the election is rigged. Everything's rigged. And so it was in a, you know, he was in a very difficult spot. They did ultimately, actually, on October 7th, 2016, before the election, come out with the first public public report from, I think it was DHS, Department of Homeland Security, and Director of National Intelligence, on the Russian hacking. Subsequently, they came out with much more detailed reports, including in January. And they briefed Donald Trump on that, but he continued to say, of course, that the whole Russia thing was a hoax and a sort of Democratic excuse for losing the election.
Yeah, and Deb Riegman, you've written also about the fact that very little has been done to assure the validity and the security of the 2018 elections, and they are no longer some sort of distant event. There are primaries for Congress taking place in Texas and Illinois next month. I mean, in a couple of weeks, we have the first round of primaries in the 2018 election cycle. So, as is often said these days, time's up. What efforts are being made, if any, to assure people that these elections are going to be without taint?
Well, this came up at the Senate Intel hearing last week. Senator Warner from Virginia, who's the ranking Democrat on the committee, was saying that he didn't think that anything had been done to help to, guarantee the integrity of the midterms. Then a Republican Senator, Risch, said that he thought that the American public was ready for the midterms because they know what the Russians are trying to do, and they can ignore it. Meanwhile, the Director of National Intelligence had the secretaries of state from all 50 states in Washington having a classified briefing so they could school them on how, you know, foreign influence is done, information warfare, the integrity of election systems. And so that was kind of their approach to reaching out to the states and trying to make sure everything is on the up and up. I think in the past months there's been some friction between the states and the federal government. You know, the election systems are state run, and they don't particularly like the idea of the feds coming in and telling them what to do. So I think there was a little bit of friction that maybe caused some delay in cooperating there. But apparently they had this classified briefing. I think it was 2 days worth. And we're supposed to be learning about what could happen seems like it's kind of late in the process. But
it does seem a little late. And when we come back from a break, we'll talk about whether or not Americans seem to be pretty adroit at detecting influence by the Russians, because Scott Shane, you have written about that at length. So we will take that up when we come back. Scott Shane is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, based in their Washington bureau. Deb Reekman is a national security reporter for the Associated Press. Quick break, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR, if you want to join the fray. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Deb Reekman from the Associated Press is on the line from Washington. Scott Shane of the New York Times is with me here in Studio A. We're talking about the Trump administration's handling of classified material and the security concerns that many have raised about the potential for Russia to once again interfere in our electoral process. Our phone number at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. So, Scott, you have written, you posted a piece, a couple of really interesting pieces, one of which is about the fact that Russia isn't the only state entity that gets itself involved in elections, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But you also wrote about that the meddling that Russia did do through the internet, Facebook and Google and that kind of thing, often happened with Americans who were unwitting victims, I guess you could call them, in this enterprise. I mean, they didn't realize who they were dealing with.
That's exactly right. There's been more detail coming out of since Friday, when Robert Mueller, the special counsel, filed an indictment of 13 Russian individuals and three Russian companies, and accused them of running this massive campaign on social media out of St. Petersburg, Russia, to essentially, meddle in our election, damage the candidacy of Hillary Clinton, promote the candidacy of Donald Trump, and generally try to pour gasoline on the flames of volatile issues like race and guns and immigration and so on. And as it turns out, there were quite a few Americans who engaged with these Russian trolls, as they call them, online through Facebook messages, through Twitter messages, and so on, and who, of course, had no idea that these guys were sitting in St. Petersburg because they were posing as fellow American activists. So if you were an anti-immigrant activist, you might hear from some guy on Facebook and go back and forth for a while, and that person might even suggest, hey, we're gonna organize a rally against increased immigration on Saturday at noon, and you want to come. And and the American would have no idea that this was actually a Russian sitting in St. Petersburg who was doing this. And, you know, in at least one instance, this actually came home to Baltimore. There was one of these Russian Facebook pages used the name Blacktivist and purported to be a group of African-American activists. And they got a little ahead of themselves and announced that they were going to organize a demonstration around the anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray. And a Baltimore pastor, the Reverend Heber Brown III, saw this, kind of realized these guys were out of town, and, you know, started messaging them and saying, you know, who are you to come in and call a rally in Baltimore? And he thought it was sort of odd. Their answer was in this not ungrammatical but somewhat peculiar English. When he challenged them, they said, "We are looking for friendship because we are fighting for the same reasons. Actually, we are open for your thoughts and offers." So
all the black folks I know talk just like that. Yeah.
So anyway, Months later, he learned that these were actually Russians and was shocked, like, you know, I think a whole lot of other people.
Yeah, well, good for Dr. Brown, who didn't fall for it.
Exactly.
But a number of people did. I mean, they were calling rallies on both sides of issues. So they had, you know, as you say, anti-immigrant rallies scheduled. And at the same time, they're scheduling like pro-Muslim rallies, you know, in the same block in the same cities across the country. So they really were working on this. I mean, Deb Riekman, the White House and the president, I shouldn't say the White House, but the president keeps using the term hoax when he talks about Russian interference in the election. Does the White House have any way of justifying that? I mean, given the latest indictments by the special counsel's office, which go into very great detail about just how the Russians were trying to influence voting and voters, what is the position of people other than the president himself when it comes to the validity of this this theory, this hypothesis that the Russians were involved?
I don't think anybody understands the reason why he won't embrace this. I mean, even his CIA director, his national intelligence director, the head of the NSA, they've all said that, you know, the Russians were meddling in the election. So I'm not sure why he won't embrace that.
It's some sort of political move. I mean, he's, I guess, speaking to people who he assumes will believe him over anybody else, the media or even other people in the administration. There are people, CNN was running clips last night and this morning about a woman who was confronted by a CNN reporter who said, you know, you were the person running this Facebook thing and all of these messages were with a Russian entity. And the woman said, no, they're not. That's all BS. You know, she just simply refused to believe, what was clearly demonstrably true.
Part of what might be going on here is also with the president in particular is, and this is understandable to a human point of view. He campaigned hard for the presidency. He won the presidency. And he does not want to think that he had assistance from Vladimir Putin and Russia in winning that office. It calls into question essentially the legitimacy of his win, of his presidency. And so I think that is one explanation why he would be, you know, strenuously objecting to the notion that the Russians somehow helped him, to the White House.
I think we need to get beyond the politics of this. I think the American public have to focus on the fact that they're trying to sow discord in the country as a whole, regardless of who wins the White House. I think this is the part that gets lost in the chatter about what Trump believes and what he doesn't believe. I think the American public have to realize what the ultimate game is here.
Yeah.
And that is to sow discord, create total skepticism of the democratic government that we have.
Yeah, and when it comes to sowing discord, of course, we Americans are pretty darn good at doing it by ourselves. We don't need a whole lot of assistance from Russia or anybody else. Let's go to the phones. Tom in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Deb Riekman and Scott Shane.
Hello, Tom and everybody. This is Tom Chalkley in Baltimore, and I've been doing a lot of research on this and reading about it for a series of comic strips called Election Hacking for Beginners, but I'm not here to plump that. It's at protectourelections.com. And basically, I'm calling because I really agree with what you guys are saying. This is a very real problem, Russian intervention. There are three agendas going on here. One is the Russian agenda. One is Trump's agenda, which, I'm sorry, Deb just explained. But there's a third agenda, and that's the Republican Party agenda. And I think, you know, up until very recently, the Republican Party was kind of getting behind Trump on, oh, this is dubious, it's a hoax, we don't know, blah, blah, blah. But I think they've come around to realize that it does create a certain amount of chaos, and you may think I'm paranoid, but why wouldn't you be in this time, in this age? But I think the Republicans have another agenda, which is by embracing the argument that the Russians are intervening, they have a way to point the finger and a cover for manipulation of the election on their part. Now, before I sound like a hyper-partisan, let's remember that there are any number of states that are severely, well, Maryland is too for the Democrats, but many more states severely gerrymandered for the Republicans. Let's remember the voter suppression tactics which they exercised in the last couple presidential elections, possibly computer hacking that was involved in Ohio in 2004. There's a lot of circumstantial things pointing to this and court testimony pointing to this that's not really gotten circulated.
But is it pointing to Republican Party involvement in hacking the computers?
Not just hacking the computers, but what I call hacking the electorate. I mean, propaganda, money, politics, that's part of it, but gerrymandering, systematic voter suppression, such as we've seen in Florida and Ohio, and also this whole wave of laws that Republican legislatures have passed, especially in the southern states that used to be under federal election.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, Tom. And, of course, there was just a Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling yesterday about gerrymandering in Pennsylvania, and there's an expectation that Democrats may do better in that state once these new lines are put into effect for this year's elections, for the November election. We have a tweet from a listener who says, with Kushner, he's talking about Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, not only that he may be blackmailed or compromised, but also could he use the info to advance his business interests or inadvertently reveal or telegraph sensitive information. And we also have a email from a listener in Chestertown, Den, who says, a government official recently opined to me that if President Trump were not president and was appointed to a position on a different president's staff, it's unlikely that he would pass a top secret security clearance review. What do you think about that? So Deb Riekman, Hillary Clinton actually had advertisements during the campaign that brought up that very notion. But he is completely inoculated from this kind of thing, given the position he holds, right?
I'm not touching that one.
I mean, but Scott, people have often said that, you know, had he been the CEO of a company and said the kinds of things he said during the course of his presidency, he would have been immediately fired. But the Constitution does allow him, as you say, to declare anything classified or unclassified.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the power that he has as commander-in-chief, which, controls all these security issues, comes from the people. He won the election, as far as we know, fair and square.
We have another indictment. This is for an attorney, Alex van der Svan, who is working in London. He's fluent in five languages, including Russian, and he had some communications with Rick Gates, the former campaign aide to Paul Manafort. This story just breaking yesterday. I mean, Deb, we just have a couple seconds left here. I mean, what do you think this latest twist? No one had ever heard of Papadopoulos before he was indicted. Now no one's ever heard of Mr. van der Svan. Now he's been indicted. What does this augur in your mind for that investigation as it continues?
Well, we had a staff meeting the other day, and we have a story that's called The Bit Players. And so the joke was that we have to keep refiring the bit player story, that there's more to come on that, that there's going to be plenty more.
Well, the bit players indeed, the not ready for prime time players, perhaps they might be referred to. Well, Deb Riekman, I appreciate your time this afternoon and your reporting. Thanks so much.
Okay.
And Scott Shane, appreciate you as well. And if listeners want to catch a little bit more of you, they can hear you this afternoon on Fresh Air with Dave Davies. Or tomorrow afternoon. Dave Davies. So we look forward to that.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Scott Shane, an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Deb Riekman covers national security for the Associated Press. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a look at recovery efforts in Puerto Rico from an aid worker who has just returned, Noah Steinberg DeStefano. He's from Lutheran World Relief, and he'll join me here in Studio A. Plus, Judy Russick is going to review Skeleton Crew at Baltimore Center Stage. Lunch for our midday guests was provided today by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton at 810 W, or West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Future Cities is up next with Wes Moore. Have a great day.